Welcome, everyone. This is Eric Ellefson. Thanks for joining me for my podcast. I'm with Dave and Doug Sikkema. Kind of started referring to him in my own notes as the Sikkema brothers, which I'm sure is not new to them. But Dave is a fourth grade teacher at Regents School in Austin, Texas, where he earned degrees in history from Queen's University, Baylor University, and University of Western Ontario. He writes about the cultural impact of digital technology on his blog for other publications and is currently teaching an after-school program for fifth and sixth grade students on digital citizenship. His brother, Doug, who's older by 10 minutes and likes to remind people of that, is a senior researcher for Cardis and the managing editor of Comment. He has taught English and history and is studying his PhD in American literature at the University of Waterloo on late 20th century American literature. Dave, you wrote an article for Comment, but then we also published it for Case, where you state that the school is not meant to be a utilitarian institution, but rather a normative institution governed by the wise, cultivating the human spirit by presenting a complete vision of man as he lives and as he ought to live in all his domains, the individual, the social, and the religious. Tell me why that drew, why that quote from Hicks draws so much from you, why that gets you excited, and why that gets you excited to talk about education, about schools, and about the work that you do.
Yeah. Well, first, thanks for having me on, Eric. I appreciate the opportunity. Yeah, so when I was writing that article, that quote stuck out to me specifically in connection to the class I teach. I think with the information age, a lot of education has been reduced down to factual information being transferred from teacher to student. And a lot of the time my students kind of ask me, what is the use of this information? If I can just get it off my phone or off the internet, to me, it speaks to a larger thought with my students, so that basically if I have access to facts, I have education, I have wisdom. The classical model that I've been teaching for the last 5-6 years now is kind of a resistance to that. It's teaching students not just what is, but what ought to be. And against the historical backdrop of pulling from 2,000 years of human history, celebrating heroes, celebrating the good, the true, and the beautiful of the past, and putting all of their facts into a larger context or tapestry of how people lived and why they lived the way they chose to live. And so, I mean, as a history teacher, when I teach my sixth graders and my fourth graders, it's not just teaching them the dates and the names of events. It's also kind of going deeper to what was the character trait of Stephen F. Austin? What was he looking for in the settlers of Texas? What was Abraham Lincoln's character in terms of the way that you framed the Emancipation Proclamation? So getting them to think more about what ought to be the reality in which we live and kind of connecting their thinking to their action. I do think a large disconnect, especially with students today as I see it, is that there's kind of the world of thought and the world of action, and they're very separate. And so they don't see a connection between what they're learning in the classroom from their teachers, specifically around the ideas of virtue. And then the action, what does it mean to now go into the world and live from these examples? And so that quote talked about norms, and David Hicks's book, Norms and Nobilities, for anybody who's interested in the classical Christian model, I'd recommend reading it. He kind of is calling us back to return to normative education with dogmas and a set of norms that kids can live within and should live within. And then he argues that that's the only way to be noble, is to kind of restrain ourselves, order our loves and order our desires within a set of normative framework. And so that, at least I pull from the study of history, that's really shaped the way that I guide my lessons in my classes.
So Doug, you're in the process of starting up a school too. And you've done a lot of research, you know, in education, a lot of work in education. Like, why, you know, expound on your brother's ideas there too. Why does this get you excited for the school that you're building and the work that you're doing too?
I think one of the things, excuse me, that excites me about this, and I agree with everything that Dave was just saying. I think one of the things that I think of when I think of sort of the utilitarian approach to education is, I think when you ask a lot of students, especially now, like, why are you going to school? What do you expect to get out of it? Whether it's in the Christian community or outside of it, we've sort of bought this narrative, or if you want to use the Jamie Smith language, we're sort of operating out of sort of liturgies of what's now, I would say, like an unhealthy market society. That a market economy, which can be a very good thing, has sort of overstepped its bounds, and it's now the sort of ordering logic of a lot of different institutions. You can see it kind of creeping into churches that are all about sort of getting bigger and bigger and bigger, creeping into schools that now think of students almost as the consumers of a product, and basically keeping students in and expanding the institution, not directed by anything that's, again, maybe normative or what they should have, but because of what students want, which will help them presumably get some kind of career for the modern world. And I think what excites me about our classical school is I don't think we're naive that there's a market component to a school. I hope not. You still need to have people who will pay tuition, who want to come there and be part of it. But that's not the sole reason. And I don't want it to be like we're pushing this because it's like, well, you know what, 9 out of 10 kids who attend a classical Christian school end up with six-figure salaries. But I think it's going back to that idea that T.S. Eliot talks about, is that the end of education is to make a sage and a saint, to make someone who's wise, which doesn't mean that they know everything. I think it's actually the beginning of wisdom is, well, fearing God, and also, as Aristotle said, and sort of Socrates, knowing your own limits. Knowing that the circumference of your ignorance kind of always expands with the radius of new knowledge. And then that you're also, as Dave was mentioning, you're embedded into a world of virtue, that we want to create a space that's not just about head knowledge, but it's actually everything from the structure and the rhythms of the day to the organization of the space is having a habit-forming influence on you. That again is fighting back this trend that says everything in education has to be geared towards a high-tech, fast-paced, ever-changing economy where jobs are the prime ticket. So if we can sort of step back and say, you know what, if you're wise and you know how to learn, those things will come when you move into some kind of job. But for now, especially at the ages of 5 to 15, 16, 17, you need a much stronger foundation. And you can be sort of transplanted into any kind of career, and you'll thrive because of the skill set, and more than that, the curiosity and love for learning that you've developed.
So, guys, I mean, you know, and this is kind of the interesting thing is you're pretty young, both of you are pretty young, and you know, we think about the world, and I'm in San Jose, where you know, innovation, where you just mentioned, you know, the speed of change, you know, all of those. Why the draw? Or how do you match the draw? Maybe I think you've given me the why the classical example, why that gets you interested. But how do you, especially maybe Dave, if you want to start this, how does this connect with kind of the innovative, the digital, the technological world, the fast-paced world? We look at artificial intelligence, you know, out here and the speed of change that's happening, you know, here in San Jose. Like, how do you match this 2,000 year history plus some and really kind of root yourself, but then also prepare yourself to be wise, to be thoughtful for, you know, a world that's changing in front of you?
That's a great question. How do you get kids interested in this? I think that's the big question. When you look at the disruptive nature of our digital moment, I think that's the philosophy of a lot of these tech giants. It's kind of like move fast, break things, disrupt culture. There's kind of a push towards reshaping the future rather than drawing from the past. And I would say that there's just a push that I see with my students is almost like, what is, like, it goes back to that utilitarian question. There's no use in looking to the past because this whole new wave of technology is, it's a young man's game, and they're the ones who navigate this world, and they're the ones with the wisdom to teach their elders. And I would, when I teach this digital citizenship class, it's kind of pulling back to be like, well, actually look at your elders and how they come before you. What is it that we can learn from them, and not just from our living elders, but the conversation they've been having for thousands of years of what does it mean to live a good life? Is the app you're developing promoting something good for humanity, or is it just something that is going to draw people's attention for a certain amount of time to bring investors in and make yourself wealthy in a short amount of time? So to me, there's kind of a push with a lot of students to move to that world, to make it big really quickly. And I think there's a failure to see the wisdom of the past and the questions that people have wrestled with in terms of what does it mean to be human? What is our calling? What is the purpose that we live here for?
Doug, how do you see this play out, you know, with the nature of what we're talking about then, but then also with some of the research that you've been doing, or, you know, how does this connect when you look at it big picture wise with, you know, the traditional sense of education or this wisdom, virtue, but then also, you know, this disruption and Dave, I mean, I think you're right on the money with some of the things that you point out, especially about disruption, you know, compared to the reshaping or the development of, you know, culture and society. So Doug, what do you think?
Yeah, I think along the lines of what Dave's saying, I just want to be careful that, like, classical sometimes gets a bad rap that, oh, you just want to kind of recover this utopian past. You're actually Luddites. You're afraid of technology. And I don't think that's the case. I think it's more like, let's look at, like, Ray Kurzweil, his sort of transhumanist project, or anybody in the sort of transhumanist movement who's constantly saying, like, how can we make life, how can we use these different apps to, right, radically change being human, when it's like the vices that still afflict us from the age of Dante to the beginning of the world, whether that's lust, greed, hatred, right, that fundamental human nature can't be changed with that kind of technology. So I think it's drawing on the fact that, like, being human, like a humanist education and a Christian humanist education, is centered around this idea of what is a good life. And I think just this sort of blind adaptation and jumping into every kind of new technological fad or movement divorced to that bigger concept of actually knowing what it means to be human, is really dangerous. And that's why, going back to even the first question of, I look at Waterloo. Waterloo is a really interesting university. It's kind of like our Silicon Valley in the north. And it's got quantum computing. It's sort of the STEM mecca for students, right? And we're, like, in the English department, some sort of side shoot of that. And what's really interesting, what's happening is that the English, philosophy, history are sort of seen as the handmaidens of those programs. And they're actually being sort of restructured and repurposed to teach engineers and technicians how to write reports and things like that, not actually giving them access to a sort of a long tradition of wisdom that could actually, as Dave was mentioning, maybe shape the apps of the future. What's even more interesting, I think, in the Waterloo context is we're actually surrounded by a big band of old order Mennonites. So you can drive 5 minutes out of the city in any direction, and you'll see horses and buggies and people operating on a completely different kind of wavelength. And in some senses, it's kind of odd. But one of the things that the Mennonite community does when they sort of adapt tech is they ask themselves a bigger question. Well, for us to flourish in our community, what would driving a car mean? What would a cell phone mean? So it's not like they actually have a really interesting way of using tech. Like, for instance, my brother just built a shed, one of my other brothers in Southern Ontario, and he found on Kijiji these Mennonites who basically use Kijiji, and then they bring some Mennonite friends and they'll come to your house and they'll build up a shed in a day. So they're kind of leveraging social media and that kind of stuff for their business. But then they're using kind of community industry to come to sort of enact a service. So again, that, I would just say that, yeah, I don't want this education to kind of come off like, no, we just want to have no technology, but it's technology in the service of human flourishing and community is key. And I think if I look at some of the trends that are happening now, even in Christian schools or more broadly, I think we're just so caught up in what's new, what's next, that we're not maybe asking those deeper questions.
Well, I'm glad you brought up the Waterloo, you know, University of Waterloo example, because I think the three of us just in this conversation, you know, using technology online to talk about education and talk about some of these things, but you being, and doing your work at University of Waterloo, the, I guess in a lot of ways, the Silicon Valley of Canada, you know, me being in San Jose, you know, kind of that hub of technology disruption and innovation. And then, you know, Dave, you being down in Austin where, you know, so many of these companies have moved to and grown into and kind of that new area of where tech is just flourishing, you know, in so many different ways. Like, what do you guys, you know, when you guys talk and when you talk about these things in education, like, what do you see that's, you know, maybe similar, but then what's kind of different about, you know, a place like, you know, up in Canada, Toronto, Waterloo, you know, compared to down in Austin, University of Texas and Texas area?
Like in terms of technology or?
Yeah, just in terms of these conversations about technology, innovation, disruption, but then also about like living the meaningful life and some of these big questions that you're asking about what does an education look like or what does it feel like or what does it, or how do we live this out together?
Yeah, and I'll start and just say that in the Hamilton context, it really depends on the school. And I can't actually speak to maybe what the public schools are doing so much, but I know some of the local Christian schools are really interested in sort of project-based learning, and getting in like sort of 3D printers and having sort of a robust technological arm, because that is sort of what the future is doing. But again, how well they sort of think through why are we doing this? Like what's the rationale? Why do our students need to have this skill set as opposed to a knowledge base or virtue base from which to use this? Is the high school the best place to do that? And again, that's one of the reasons why we decided to kind of start this school, is to, again, at the ground level, ask some of those more basic questions.
Yeah, and in Austin, I would say, I've run a few parent talks now with the community just on smartphone use with their students, anywhere from fourth grade all the way up through eighth grade. And a common concern that I see with the parents again and again is, I feel like this is wrong. I feel like this is actually just the most negative influence on my student, yet I don't really know what to do. And I think so much too of the way that we raise our children is influenced by the behaviors of the community that we find ourselves in. So you can have a strong resistance to having phones in your home, but if you're in a community where all your students have it, that pull is just challenging. And so I think that's what I see too, is a lot of families kind of catering to their students' desires and what they need. A classical education doesn't necessarily just cater to the self, but it tries to form the self and tries to do tough things. And so that might actually look like we remove all digital technologies from our students when they come in. We have some in the classroom, but for the most part, we just remove those, because I do think the disruptive nature of them, it disrupts their attention, and it's meant to. I mean, the programmers have designed these to draw their attention constantly. But it's an uphill battle. I don't know what the answer really is. I think popular culture, social media, this idea that every student is kind of their own celebrity in their own reality show that they create and control is the biggest unasked question. Or there's, I don't know. I think a lot of solutions need to be figured out in the next 5 to 10 years with this new generation coming through school, because it is radically changing the way that students learn and the way that students even want to learn. I noticed that on a field trip, and I don't want to come across negatively. I mean, I don't know who's all listening to this. It was just clear to me that there's a certain level of feeling like a constant need to be entertained. And when things are boring, there's no need to just like sit in that boredom and just listen. Like, what are my docents saying at this museum? Even if they're elderly and don't speak that loud, what can I learn from them? And what can I quietly just reflect on? But if it's, it seems that if something doesn't entertain instantly or have anything to do with them or with you, it's kind of, you're just used to scrolling to something new and moving on. And so I think that, I feel like that's an unanswered question.
Right, I would say like that Andy Crouch book, like the TechWise family, there almost needs to be like a second volume, like the TechWise classroom. So I think we've adopted a lot of Andy Crouch's ideas, even in our own household. And it's interesting that when our twins were going, it just seemed, oh, how do you resist putting on Paw Patrol? Besides that show being just terrible, right? That should be enough of a reason not to put it on. But it's like this crazy drug, and it's like the kids just like love Paw Patrol, and you can kind of anesthetize them. And then Andy Crouch has this thing, like, I don't give my kids screens till they're 10. And again, we don't treat it like Bible, like there's, but he's like, you have to control technology or technology will control you. And I think sometimes we get locked into this condition, and like you were saying, Dave, like the pop culture, that it's just like everybody seems to be doing it, and there's so much pressure that it can't be otherwise. And all it takes is trying it and saying, you know what, like when we come home, put our cell phones in our bedroom and put them away, shut them, turn off the, like, don't respond to them, right? Don't, like, even if your kids are fighting and crying and screaming, right, be the parent as someone who has experience and actually put that limit and say, you know what, no, even though you want this, it's not good for you in the long run. And I'm here to play the long game, not the short game. And it's amazing even in 2 or 3 years of doing this, our kids' imaginations and what they can all do now in their boredom. And again, we don't get it perfect. We often fall in. We don't hold ourselves, I think, sometimes to the same standards that we ask of our kids, which is another big problem. But I think in the classroom, it can be otherwise. And I think to just constantly cater and say, no, students want this and everybody's doing it, it's the 21st century, I think it's a dangerous game to fall into.
Right. And I should add, our school has a no smartphone iPad policy.
Right.
Anyway.
So guys, you know, as we think about, you know, kind of, you know, maybe, you know, just even as we wrap up and close up, and Doug, I know you're doing some research, you know, on with CARDIS and on education, but Dave, want to get your thoughts, especially as a parent, but then even in the classroom, like how much of this is just, and you talked about, you know, the parent stuff and the re-education, how much of this is just engaging, you know, adults in the process of having conversations and then even for them to disconnect in some way so that then they can, you know, really kind of contemplate some of these big questions that you're even asking of the students.
Exactly. Yeah, you know, it's an interesting thing. When I start my class, I ask them, the kids, all their different views of what do their parents say about technology. And it's interesting in terms of the limits they've been imposed on, the curfews, the lack of technology they're allowed to have or they want to have. And then I switch it. What are your views of your parents' media habits and things like that? And it's really telling that they'll say, well, I'm playing basketball and I look over after I've scored and my parents are on their phone. And there's just a constant sense of, I don't get why I'm being told to live this way when everything that's being modeled for me from the adult generation is exactly opposite of that. And there's a level where it's okay, we're parents and you're children. There is going to be a little bit of a double standard, but I do think telling parents the most important way you can teach your children is by modeling the type of humans you want them to be. If you want them to be lifelong learners, you need to be a lifelong learner. And that doesn't mean just bringing in instruments into your house or art supplies. And it also means maybe you walk them through certain apps on their phone with you. Like, hey, I'm on Instagram. This is a picture I'm taking. This is something I'm creating, why I'm doing it. Kind of stepping down into their world with them a little bit, helping them navigate the waters before they go off and do it independently. But I do think a big part of the conversation that I've really enjoyed having is typically with the parents in terms of what behavior they're modeling and how important that is, because whether you like it or not, we're always leading, and our example and our behaviors typically speak more volumes to our students and to our children than any opinions we might have on something. So, I mean, my boy's only 10 months old, but it's telling to me that he's already watching every move I make, mm-hmm. and how quick I am to flip out my phone and take pictures and videos of him. And as I turn on the camera, I see his smile just fade because he doesn't actually see what I see. He just sees a big black iPhone in front of his face between me and him. And suddenly our faces aren't connected anymore. And he realizes that. And he's wondering what it is I'm looking at, probably. But it's just telling to me as a teacher and as a parent, my behaviors ultimately is a lesson for my students to be learning.
And you told Ari no Skype interviews, right? And now he's watching you do this. No podcast until you're...
You know, so Doug, maybe you can kind of finish us up with, you know, and close us out with, you know, some of the research that you're doing on schools with CARDIS, and then just even some of the maybe the other work that you're doing overall to get a better understanding of the impact in particular of Christian school education.
Yeah, so a few things that we're working on. One is the ongoing CARDIS education survey, and it's a survey that we do for graduates of Christian schools. They're about 10, 20 years out, looking at a whole range of things. And actually, one of the things we do to circle back to the first question about utilitarian versus normative education is we're the only sort of education survey that asks more than just what are you making, what's your highest degree, you know what I mean, like how successful has your school been in getting you into this kind of career. We ask all kinds of things about civic engagement. Do you vote? How involved are you in your community? To just daily habits. Do you pray around the table? Do you eat meals together? Do you, right? What does your actually family life look like? So the CARDIS Education Survey, really what we focused it on 2 years ago when I helped Beth in the writing of that was education to sort of love our neighbor. So if that's actually the metric, if you can boil down every vision statement, everything is actually good education is about how we best serve God, yes, but also serve the surrounding community. What schools are doing that the best? So when you isolate for every other factor except for where somebody went to school, there's really interesting findings that if you went to a Christian private school, whether that's Catholic or Protestant, but often the schools are independent off the grid from maybe public funding. Not all the metrics, but most of the metrics show that those schools outperform at least their counterparts in the public. So what we're doing is we're measuring the public as sort of the baseline and then who does more or less. So more giving to charity, abroad and locally, sort of better habits of family life, higher degree of sort of fidelity in marriage, a better chance of being married and having stronger family ties. So that's sort of the CARDIS Education Survey. And we're just, again, year by year doing sort of longitudinal studies. So we have to look in the US and Canada, how effective are our private Christian schools in doing what they set out to do. We're also doing some interesting work as I was mentioning to you before with Trinity Western University, trying to find not just quantitative, because I think sometimes the public sphere kind of demands quantitative analyses. And that's part of the reason why CARDIS got into this, is that if you want it to be heard, you had to have the measurements to back it up. Now that we have that, we're almost kind of swinging back a little bit and saying, can we get some qualitative reporting on the ground? Because 30,000 foot high, a 30,000 foot high sort of view of the landscape is good for certain things, but it doesn't sort of tell you what is the nitty gritty detail of different schools. So we're actually in the process of trying to find the 10 best schools that are in Canada and what they're doing in terms of governance, in terms of pedagogy and curriculum. And we want to find those stories and then give sort of case study reports that we can actually send those out, knowing that, again, every school is really shaped and responding to a certain community and condition. But there's often these practices that can be sort of translated and transplanted into other places. So we're working on telling those stories as well. A third thing that we're working on, we're doing some data gathering with Barna around pastor attitudes to education. Because if we think of education as something that the family is responsible for, that's like the first social unit where education has to happen. It's also sort of working with the grain of the state and the church, and those things need to sort of be working together. And I think a missing piece, it seems, is lately there's maybe not a shared idea among different leaders of churches as to what education is for, who's responsible for it. And is it just the state's job? Is it the state's job to educate our kids? If so, what does that look like? If not, maybe what is the parameters and the balance to it? So we're trying to find that data out in a U.S. context as to what are pastors actually talking as actually key influencers of communities for what education is and what it's for, and where does Christian education actually fit into that whole mix?
Guys, I really appreciate you taking some time this on this Monday after Easter, and just really enjoy the conversation and look forward to being able to possibly follow up with future conversations.
Sounds good, Eric.
Thanks. Sounds good. Thanks.